This is the November 3rd climate change law class. We've wrapped up announcements. We've talked about Indonesia's new status as the largest greenhouse gas emitter on the planet, reviewed some of the wrangling over the Senate's attempt to force EPA to respond to attempts to harmonize the language of 111D, and briefly touched on and answered questions about the 111D clean power plan discussion last week. To begin, though, before we start talking about NEPA today, I did want to clarify there was one question from last week, which was, what is the difference between the regulatory definition of a stationary fossil fueled steam electrical generation unit as opposed to a stationary combustion turbine? And I did go through, and Albert, I don't know if you've done it, you said you were going to check and see if you had anything on that.
Yeah, I have not had a chance yet.
Okay. I did verify through the regulations, it's what we thought, and essentially, using the bad markers, which I will start complaining about as soon as I start putting them to the board. Essentially, picture a energy source with a coil inside. Well, actually, that's not the right way to do that. Picture an energy source in the form of burning something. This could be essentially heating a large vessel of water. The water turns to steam, and the steam expands. It goes through a piping system that then goes to a generator and is used because of its motion and energy to turn the blades of the generator to generate electricity. But as it does so, the energy is transferred, it cools back down, and is conveyed in water form back in. So essentially, it's a loop. The thing here is that this could be any fossil fuel source. Coal, nat gas, petroleum is used for powering some sources, as opposed to an actual gas turbine, where the actual combustion change colors here. You inject the natural gas, you actually have turbine usually the turbine's fanned out. You know, picture it has blades on the side poking out. Essentially, it's just like your car. You inject the natural gas here, and the natural gas is ignited. It essentially explodes, and the combustion process expands, and it's used to actually push the turbine to generate the power. Why does that matter? Two reasons. One, by removing this step of the intermediate transfer through a different medium, by burning it, heating the water, turning it to steam, and pushing the coil, this is much, much more efficient. Second, this also is much more amenable to what they call combined cycle, where essentially this gas that's been created to burn and push the turbine is still hot. So it comes out and you can actually use it to power another turbine or another type of heat capture device that can be translated to energy. So you get double layers of efficiency. In theory, you could use petroleum, you could use pulverized or gasified coal to do the same thing here. That's part of the point of IGCC. But again, you're adding additional steps to translate one power source into another medium, so it's not quite as efficient as just pure, straight methane natural gas. So that's why we have different standards. You'll notice that the BTU, CO2 per kilowatt hour for this is higher because it's less efficient, but EPA felt that they could go lower with this because the efficiency rating meant that you could get more kilowatts for less CO2. But that also is a side effect of basically making this less competitive over the long run if you set the standard low enough so that the only way a new unit like this can work is if you capture and sequester the carbon dioxide. So does that help?
So you can use coal for this one. It's just not, it's not as economical as using natural gas, which is why it's not done as much.
To use coal here, you can't, this one you can, on this side, you can do it, you know, pulverize the coal, you can make it very fine, you make it easy to burn. Here, essentially, you have to gasify. So that gasification step creates its own energy penalty. It also creates its own pollution step, and it's less efficient. So you can use coal, you just have to turn it into a liquid or gas.
So, but under the Clean Power Plan, were they thinking that people were going to actually do that and writing these rules, or did they know, like, this is really going to be, like, this is going to privilege natural gas because of the way we're doing this?
Without anyone telling me this, this is my interpretation.
Right.
This privileges natural gas.
Right.
The process I was talking about, the IGCC, or basic gasification of coal, is not portrayed as part of this side of the measure. It's actually viewed as a control measure on
this
side.
That's what I thought. That's what I was getting confused.
Right.
Okay.
So, in other words, if you're having trouble meeting this limit and you don't want to do carbon capture sequestration, EPA says fine. The state can also require IGCC as a control measure here.
Okay.
Good question, Seth. Any others? All right. So, with that, we leave the Clean Air Act behind, but I am serious about this. Open invitation. If other questions come to mind, if you have anything else you want to revisit, the Clean Air Act is where the action is, bottom line. We're going to talk about clean water, we'll talk about endangered species, we'll talk about NEPA. Clean air is where it's really going to be, where the United States lives or dies in its climate commitments. So with that in mind, NEPA. Before I start diving in, how many folks here have had some experience with NEPA before? In what context?
I don't know how it factored in exactly, but submitting comments for wetlands mitigation, and I guess NEPA factored in somehow if it would have been deemed a major, was a major federal action with significant.
And this is with Charles's
right, okay. And so in submitting some of the comments, we kind of like brought up some of the stuff that would have to be discussed in a NEPA analysis too.
All right, well then what I'd like to do, for the rest of you, have you had exposure to NEPA in your other classes? I know folks of you who suffered through environmental law with me have had some of this before. What I'd like to do is go through the building blocks of NEPA, and actually then, Nick, if you could sort of think about your project as an example to highlight some of the things we're going to walk through. And then once you guys have a sense of what NEPA's bones are like, let's apply it to climate change. And then we can talk about in particular the cases in our casebook. And then I can update you where the book stops, because some interesting things have happened since the chapter was written last year. So with that in mind, welcome to NEPA, which is usually the launch pad for most environmental law classes. This is the granddaddy. It's the first major modern federal environmental statute, 1969. As a result, it's a different beast than almost every other environmental statute. As you know now from wandering through the Clean Air Act, to those of you who have suffered under RCRA, as you'll see with the Clean Water Act, most federal environmental statutes tend to be very detailed, very structured, very focused on state-federal relations, very much geared in the idea that there's a technically driven standard that must be attained. NEPA is not about that. NEPA is very much about integrating a different philosophy of decision making in federal rulemaking. So as a result, it has some almost oddly poetic, 1970s groovy language in it. Often do you see a statute who says, that its national policy is to, quote, maintain and create conditions under which man and nature can exist in productive harmony, close quote. So think about where we're coming from here. The bottom line is that NEPA is process. And y'all may have heard, some of you may have heard me say this before. NEPA is not about where your decision ends up. Its sole focus is that certain aspects of decision making are fully and thoroughly considered in a hard look. But if the agency makes a decision, NEPA cannot be used to challenge the substance of that decision, only about the way that decision was made. So, with that in mind then, what are the elements? What's the bones that you have to go through if you're an agency? And at the risk of falling into my favorite trope, which is the magic sentence, here are the ingredients you need to have when you're conducting a NEPA assessment. Wait, new markers? Oh man! Where were you 4 weeks ago? That's fabulous. Thank you.
You're welcome. Maybe somebody complained that you were throwing markers around in class.
That's not my brightest moment. All right.
That would totally blow my phone. Okay. For NEPA, here's what you got to have. NEPA applies if you have a major federal action that significantly affects the quality of the human environment. That's the engine. And as always, it sounds simple, but every one of those terms packages layers of meaning in it. So the ones we're going to talk about most right now are going to be what's a federal or major action, but then the bulk of our discussion for climate change purposes is about what is significantly affects. For now, have that sentence, put it in quotes, underline it, and now set it to the side a little bit, because I'll make sure we get the big picture before we start drilling down. Assume you have a significant federal action that significantly affects the quality of the human environment, what then? NEPA sets out a framework of particular ways the agency or federal actor must respond. So essentially there are four pathways. One is a categorical exclusion. Essentially that means that the agency has looked in advance and determined that it knows, looking forward, without knowing the specifics of the project, this type of activity does not require an environmental impact statement. So it's excluded. Second, an environmental assessment. This is your first look-see, your 10,000 foot view. This is where you determine whether or not you need an environmental impact statement by looking at the big parameters of the decision. And if you determine that there's not a federal, major federal agency action that significantly affects the human environment, quality of the environment, you have what's called a FONSI, a finding of no significant impact. So essentially, it's entirely possible that you can have an environmental assessment that's fairly brief, short, targeted, and high level, that concludes that even with that base of information, there is no significant impact, and therefore NEPA stops. That is how the vast bulk of agency actions get resolved. It is the rare, unlucky agency action that draws the short straw of having a full-fledged environmental impact statement, which is the fourth route. So again, I kind of, at the risk of making sure I was clear about this, one is categorical exclusion, two is environmental assessment, three is a finding of no significant impact, four is an environmental impact statement. And that's, for environmental impact statement is what we know about. This is where the pitched battles of environmental legal history have been fought. It's essentially the detailed assessment of the environmental consequences of an action. They can be 30 pages long. I've seen some that would fill literally a room of this size. Depends on the nature, size, complexity of the action. Now, an environmental impact statement has mandated things it must consider and look at. So these mandates and requirements are spelled out by regulation. So for those of you who are planning to become NEPA mavens, the regulations we care about are not from EPA. They're actually, every federal agency has their own NEPA regulations, but the ones that matter most, the traffic cop for NEPA, is the Council for Environmental Quality at the White House. They set the master rules, which other agencies follow, adapt, and implement. Under the CEQ regulations, they spell out what the environmental impact statement must incorporate and what the ways it must do it. And essentially what they say is that the agency must consider the following. First of all, they must consider the type of action. And there's three varieties there. You need to consider whether these are connected actions, beyond just the one the agency is doing, but other actions that are directly and causally related to them. Second, cumulative actions, other actions that are parallel to, but also part of the constellation of action. And third, similar actions. Beyond that, you also have to consider three types of alternatives. And then last, three types of impacts. And here's where the real fighting starts. You have to consider whether or not you have a cumulative impact, bless you, a direct impact, or an indirect impact. And I just wanted to spell those out because your book includes and mentions all these elements, but as aspects of climate change cases. And I want to make sure it's very clear to you that these apply to every environmental impact statement. And it's very formulaic to a certain extent. Every environmental impact statement is going to have, bless you. Your Albert's rubbing off on you. There must be something in the vent over you guys, I think. So every environmental impact statement is going to include at least some facial discussion of direct, indirect, and cumulative impacts. They're required to. Otherwise, it's spatially insufficient. Now, once you've got those assessments of the actions and impacts, the environmental impact statement clunks along a certain predefined path. It next requires that you have to have an assessment of what adverse impacts result from those actions. And those are ones that cannot be avoided. That invites a discussion of mitigation steps. And then last, you have a discussion of what feasible alternatives there are. And that's where the true spirit of NEPA is. You can have a detailed discussion of the significant effects of certain actions. That doesn't mean a thing unless you then have, on the other hand, what the agency could do instead and whether or not those have less action impacts. So what you're talking about is not only looking at the action itself and looking at it broadly, you're also then looking at alternatives to it, but then doing the same sort of NEPA review of the impacts and collateral consequences of those actions so you can have a full and measured evaluation of the action the agency is going to take. Does that all hang together for everyone so far? Notice what it doesn't have. Nowhere does NEPA says you have to choose the environmentally protected one. All the agency has to do is fully, completely follow the procedures and flesh out the alternatives and the consequences, and then it's up to the agency. They can choose to disregard. They can choose a different path according to NEPA. Now here's where I do have to sort of introduce the real world. What do you think happens to the agency that goes through this process and develops alternatives and then says, I've developed this alternative and it shows these damages. I send this a feasible alternative that doesn't have these damages. Nonetheless, I'm choosing the first one that causes damages. NEPA may say that's fine. What I'm suggesting to everyone here is the Administrative Procedure Act does not. That is ripe for the picking as an arbitrary and capricious action. That brings me to my last point, which is that NEPA is really typically implemented in conjunction with the APA. NEPA does not have a citizen supervision, unlike almost every other federal environmental statute. So what that means is that when an agency goes through this process or chooses not to go through this process, and someone wants to fight them, it's almost always going to be an action under the APA, under Section 700 through 707, and those actions will contest the whether the action was arbitrary and capricious or failed to have sufficient record to support the action. So all the stuff you had in ad law or statutory interpretation come back to life in the NEPA context. So with that sort of quick look-see, any questions about how the NEPA bones all fit together before we start applying to climate change? And Nick, is that sort of captured? Is that how it worked for you in terms of your project with Charles and
Yes, Barrett? We were submitting comments for actually a wetland project. So before the agency decided whether it had to do an EIS, we were kind of suggesting that if they have to do one, the stuff that we want them to be sure to look at as far as like cumulative effects, indirect effects, direct effects.
Okay. And what was the project again?
They were filling a portion of the Galveston Bay, and it was like some industrial company that wanted to put like a loading dock or something. So they were basically paving part of the bay.
Okay.
And so we were making sure that when I guess it would have been the Corps of Engineers approved the 404 permit, that if they had to do an EIS, that they, you know, look at all these things in composing it.
Okay. All right, thanks. So, I'm sorry, Caroline, were you just...
I was just going to ask, I don't really understand how, if it doesn't have a citizen suit, how you bring it in conjunction with the APA.
The APA creates a right of action against the government. And I just phrase this carefully. You can sue if you are a party who has been injured by the government's failure to comply with the substantive standards of decision making in Section 706 of the Administrative Procedure Act. Most federal environmental statutes, that's not necessary because they contain their own separate mini APAs within them for citizen supervision. But NEPA has to rely on the Administrative Procedure Act instead. Right. So,
actually, this is the best part. Throw those away. Now, here's the beauty. I'll probably try this now, and it's going to be just as bad. Okay, so just to make sure everyone's paying attention, what are the elements again for NEPA?
Major federal action.
Significantly affects quality of human environment.
All right. We're going to spend almost all of our time on this. And believe it or not, this is actually almost as bad as the one I just threw away. I want to give credit, though. They try. These are just erasers. Okay. We're going to hardly talk about this at all. But before we put in the rearview mirror, and the book rarely talks about it as well, I wanted to highlight a few things for you that are important from a practice perspective, especially for climate change. First of all, major is very, very, very broadly defined. It, to a certain extent, almost conflates with whether or not this is an effect, but major action basically involves any kind of rulemaking, any kind of determination, any kind of program. Where you start getting to a fight is if it's a guidance or some other type of informal agency action that is not triggering APA review. The bottom line is that this is very loosely interpreted. Here's the one people forget, federal. So, for example, what was the exact permit you guys were fighting over with Charles and Mary?
It was a 404 fill permit.
Which is issued by?
The Corps of Engineers.
Right. So, if I want to fight an NSR permit in Texas, can I do a NEPA challenge to it, Albert?
No.
Why?
Because that would be administered by TCEQ, which is a state body.
Okay. So if I wanted to fight a greenhouse gas permit issued in Texas?
Yes. Because currently the EPA Region 6, if I recall correctly, issues GHG permits.
Close. Time has caught up to you from behind, though, but you're about to be right again. Remember our discussion this Tuesday about PSD and NSR and the tailoring. And that rule basically was implemented in such a way that facilities had to get a greenhouse gas PSD permit if they exceeded the thresholds. Texas, I'm sure you'll be shocked to discover, said, hell no, we're not going to do it. EPA responded with a FIP, and that meant that essentially every air permit in Texas got split. The one that dealt with criteria pollutants and other normal conventional pollutants went to Austin. The greenhouse gas portion went to Dallas for consideration by EPA Region 6, which means that this kicks in. Normally, you never have to do a NEPA analysis for an air permit in Texas, except if you have a significant piece of it that's picked up by the federal government. Every permit that had the greenhouse gas component was having to be run through two locators at the same time, and more importantly, an environmental impact statement. Ross talked about on Thursday the Endangered Species Act. You had to do an Endangered Species Act determination for federal action under Section 7. You don't have to do that with state permits. So the federal aspect of this is very important. What happened, Albert, is basically the Texas legislature got so much pushback and complaint from the industrial community that they actually directed TCEQ to implement a greenhouse gas permit. So we do not require federal permits now for PSD permits. Here's where you're right again. What's going to happen with the Clean Power Plan? That's a theoretical, rhetorical question, but you can take a stab at it if you want.
I would presume that Texas is once again going to push back, so we won't have a SIP for it, which means that we'll have to go back to the EPA to get a permit under a FIP.
Mm-hmm. By the way, the chief of staff, if I remember correctly, from the Texas Attorney General's office confirmed in Chicago on Thursday, no one is preparing a fallback plan for Texas to have a state version of the Clean Power Plan. Whether that's bluff, no one really knows for sure. But let's just simply say on the table right now, Texas is basically saying, FIP me, I dare you. If that happens, we're back into this. You're going to be doing NEPA assessments for issuances of any major new fossil fuel power plant, either coal, fire, or natural gas. So there's so much to talk about there, but I'm going to stop. I'll just simply say there are folks in the industry groups who are very, very worried that they're going to have to do the same thing they did with PSD permits, and actually have to push the legislature to force the governor's office to make TCEQ actually issue state regulations to implement the Clean Power Plan that they're fighting at court at the same time. Welcome to Texas. All right, so major federal action, and action's pretty much self-defining. Any questions about that first step? Because now we can get to the real grist of it. Significantly effective.
Sorry, just procedurally, so when you make that need assessment on a permit, it's to determine whether you even issue a permit. Is that what it's for?
The NEPA assessment is a consideration of the environmental impact of a decision to issue the permit. So it must be done before the permit is issued. You're correct in that respect. You can actually get an injunction to halt the issuance of a permit if the agency has not gone through a NEPA assessment previously, if it's a major federal agency action. Is that, am I getting to what you're asking about?
Yeah, I just didn't see how it, I was having trouble understanding how it relates to the permits.
Yeah, basically, if a federal agency is about to issue a permit, think about the ways it could play out. Either the agency says, this is not a major federal agency, major federal action, we're not going to do NEPA, you sue them on that determination. They could say that it is a federal major federal action, but we're just going to do a environmental assessment in a FONSI, you can sue them on that determination. Or you can sue them on the actual content of the EIS. If they want to roll ahead without going any kind of NEPA assessment, you can seek injunctive relief to prevent that action from going forward. There's some pretty good case law to support that. The balancing of that injunction has been questioned by the Supreme Court recently, but we've had injunctions, for example, challenging the permit approvals of planting of genetically modified seeds or approvals of pesticides. It covers a broad category of things.
Would it be fair to also say that NEPA doesn't go towards the merits of whether you should get the permit, but it's to say you need to be prudent and consider your impact on the environment?
Absolutely. Okay. And is that what you're asking, Andrew?
Yeah.
Okay. Sure. Sorry, Albert. I should have been channeling Albert for that answer. Yes?
So, like, for example, if, you know, you're doing a NEPA on a permit and you have to do the full-blown thing with the EIS and everything, when, like, you have to consider alternatives, would that be alternatives to issuing the permit itself or alternatives for the project that the permit is being issued to?
Yes, is a short answer. Every environmental impact statement by regulation has to include a no action alternative. So your environmental impact assessment would either environmental assessment or impact statement mm-hmm. is going to say no action here, presumably don't issue the permit. But then you look at, if you issue the permit, what are feasible alternatives? You could issue a permit with conditions that you implement certain types of mitigation steps.
Okay.
Or you could look at it permitting under a completely different program. It depends on what the project definition invites as an alternative to its scope of action.
Okay.
In doing the EA to determine if you need to do an EIS, it seems like a lot of like the stuff in an EIS gets folded into that, like mm-hmm. talking about the type of action, the types of impacts. So I guess it's just kind of up to the agency to decide how much detail they want to go to in the EA, but to make sure they do enough to kind of prove to a court if they got sued that they did like a thorough enough look at it. Like, so I guess my question is, like, it seems like in the EA a lot of times they end up doing like in almost a full-blown EIS, is that something that you see commonly? Do they do that to kind of cover their bases?
You see it when you have an action that's likely to be controversial, which I pause at because the fact that it's controversial oftentimes is enough to require an environmental impact statement. But if they're going to get scrutiny or challenge on it, you'll see an environmental assessment that looks a lot like an EIS. But in theory, it's not required. And once you get outside that small core of ones that might get some heat, the vast majority of environmental assessments are pretty pro forma, you know, 5-10 pages.
So they don't have to talk about the agency types of impacts in there. They don't necessarily have to.
They do, but they can do it in a fairly cursory fashion.
Right.
So the whole point is that's supposed to not be an EIS.
Sure.
Particularly if they tailor their EA to any comments that were raised, then their record is pretty much developed to support their findings.
Right. And something that's important for both of your answers, since it's the Administrative Procedure Act, don't forget that means essentially the same constraints of the Administrative Procedure Act requirements apply. Basically, it's record review. If the agency does an environmental assessment, decides not to do something, they have to be able to point to what's in the record to support that, and they can't point anywhere else. So you may have an EA, but the EA needs to have a docket supporting it to survive a court jump if someone goes after it. And even if the deferential standard helps the agency, they're still going to be fairly concerned with that. All right, so major federal action. Next up is significantly affects, and this is where the vast amount of wrestling goes on with the, climate change. First of all, remember the CEQ, the traffic cop. CEQ's regulations do explicitly define what significantly affects must include, things that can make something significant. And it's a laundry list, as you might expect. If something is controversial, if something may create a legal precedent that affects future actions, if it has unique aspects, all these can contribute to a determination under the CEQ regulations that the action is significant. But it's not infinite. For example, it's interesting, NEPA expressly talks about aesthetic impacts and how it means to preserve cultural aspects. The court's been very blunt. Psychic harm is not sufficient to trigger NEPA review. The agency does not have to consider whether or not someone's going to be upset in their environmental impact statement. They do have to consider whether the action itself is controversial, but you don't have to say, basically, if someone's distressed by the appearance of something, that that's enough. So what does that mean in terms of NEPA and climate change? It's a surprisingly small set of core cases that have been most influential, and the book's been good about including them here. For those of you who are interested in a bigger picture, I recommend to you the Columbia Law School Climate Change Litigation Chart. I think it's climatelitigationchart.org. It's a comprehensive compilation of every NEPA case ever filed in the United States and how they got resolved. But the ones that matter most for us right now, Center for Biological Diversity versus National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, which is a circuit court decision, Ninth Circuit, 2008, which talks about essentially CAFE standards, fuel efficiency for fleet vehicles. So why are we starting here? Why does this one matter? This one discusses what an agency must do before it can determine something is not significant. This is a weird case. This is a case where the agency actually promulgated new fuel efficiency standards for fleet vehicles that reduced greenhouse gas emissions. They were challenged because the rules were not aggressive enough. So what we're talking about is the significant effect we're talking about is the missed opportunity for greater emission reductions, which may explain some of the kind of shifty language in this case. Backdrop here, and going back to Nick's point originally, what we're talking about, keep in mind, is an environmental assessment that decided ultimately that there was no significant impact. So this is a second guess of the agency's decision not to do an environmental impact statement. So time being a little short, let me kind of tick off some of the key points, and we can kick them around if you'd like to. But takeaways, things that are buried in the decision that I'd really, really like for you to know when you're practicing in the real world out there. One is kind of alighted over, but the first thing the agency argued was that we don't have a choice. There is no decision here because the statute directed us to issue these fuel efficiency standards and constrained the factors we could use in choosing it. If there's no choice, there's no reason for NEPA to apply because your consideration of alternatives is useless. It doesn't make a difference. And that argument has been successful in other cases. You have to have, as an irreducible, necessary first step, some agency discretion that's being exercised. And what the Ninth Circuit here said essentially was the agency was wrong. That while the statute did require them to take action and set parameters for that action, even within it, though, there was a spectrum of alternatives that it could have chosen from even within those factors. So as a result, they couldn't step out of the NEPA process just based on that. Here's where we get to the nitty-gritty. What does it mean to say something significant The regulations, CEQ regulations, say specifically you have to look at context plus intensity. And intensity is where most of the agency actions get swept in. The laundry list is buried in your decision, but I invite you to take a look at the top of page 716. That has the excerpt from the regulatory language that essentially lists one after another all the different factors. The ones that seem to be the most important, just in routine practice, it talks about highly controversial actions can be considered to be significant on that ground alone. It also says that based on cumulative impacts, an action can be significant on that ground alone. All you need is one of that laundry list to trigger a determination that's significant. In this case, those two factors are the ones that got the court to conclude that the decision that the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration here was significant, and that it did require further determination that an environmental impact statement might be warranted. But the environmental assessment glided too quickly over what the potential impact might be. So, other takeaways very quickly, then we can kick around the case more. What we're talking about here is that the agency determined that the emissions were decreased by 0.2%, and that therefore, given the global picture of greenhouse gas emissions, by definition, that is not significant. The Ninth Circuit relied on the cumulative impact analysis to say simply, though, that's not enough. That what matters is what's the impact of adding that small incremental amount on top of all the other emissions we already know are going to the atmosphere, and that you can have non-linear effects. Simply saying it's small is not enough. You have to look at the impact caused by that small addition. That's a change. Most of the prior cases tended to focus on what we call the 1% rule, saying that if the effect was to increase less than 1% emissions, that the courts tended to just dismiss that or affirm the agency's dismissal of those out of hand. I suggest to you that's no longer the case. As the science developed, the courts are more scrutinizing of emissions below 1%. And the last takeaway here is look at the remedy. The remedy here was that most Pyrrhic of victories, the remand back to the agency. They did not direct the preparation of the environmental impact statement. What does that mean? I'm sure you guys have suffered through this before in your ad law class or in your statutory interpretation class. Remand simply means the agency gets to do it again, and they can reach exactly the same answer. They just have to buttress the record more to justify why they reached the same answer. And that's what happened in this case. That's the flaw of NEPA. And I don't mean to sound too cynical, and maybe I'll have to eat these words with Mary and Charles later. NEPA is a statute you pull out not because it wins the day. You put it this way, almost every NEPA case that's gone before the Supreme Court in the past 20 years, the environmental proponents have lost. That's not the point. NEPA is enormously effective in imposing procedural steps that make it more difficult to carry through an action, even if the agency theoretically can still do it at the end of the day. Death by 1,000 paper cuts. Delay. And I don't mean to impugn that strategy by calling it that, but it's a very effective strategy. You can force a careful consideration and force a reconsideration again at every step, one step forward, two steps back, to the point where other factors of commerce or politics intervene and make the decision unsupportable. You know, the money just runs out. The political will is no longer there. And while this is not a NEPA case, I'd say Keystone XL is perhaps a wonderful example of that exact process happening right now. So now I've rattled on a long time on my own. Any questions then about this particular case or the concept of significance, significantly affects?
So even if an agency is doing something that's a net positive to the environment, that could still trigger NEPA. Is that something that was around before this case and kind of good law that even if an agency's doing something that's going to, like, you know, by all accounts, improve the environment?
Yes. The short answer is look at the alternatives. If there's an alternative that is much better for the environment,
right,
the fact that you're putting a Band-Aid on may be challengeable. And that was a concept that had been supported prior to this decision, but not as clearly in the NEPA climate change context. Good question, though. Any others? All right. Okay. So that's sort of your warhorse. That's the engine. That's the key thing. Significant effects is interpreted in a way to include a fairly large laundry list of key things that can make an action significant, and that the agency can be second-guessed on its decision not to prepare EIS, and it can be second-guessed in terms of what the remedy it chooses, or the court could choose a remedy on it. So let's dig in a little deeper. How far do you have to look? What does it mean if you have a significant action? What do you have to assess in terms of the action itself and its alternatives? And again, the CEQ regulations play the role. Namely, CEQ demands that if you have a significant action, you have to examine its direct, indirect, and cumulative effects.
Is NEPA confined to the United States?
Oh, what a fabulous question. Short answer is no, but at this, at the risk of scrambling the things I want to talk about, and I'm trying to think of a way to make this more of a dialogue with you, but I'll throw it out there. You can tell me whether or not this makes sense or disagree. Remember, by definition, every NEPA lawsuit has exclusive venue in federal courts. You can only sue in a federal court. That means Article 3 kicks in. That means that if you are going to bring a NEPA lawsuit challenging an agency action in another nation, you have to be able to establish that you have Article 3 standing to be a plaintiff in that context. And the courts have been very stingy in taking a look as to parties who contest an agency action in another nation unless they can show direct, individual, personal, concrete, traceable harm. And a lot of cases just never make it past that burden. Having said that, yeah, there have been NEPA cases, for example, on the Export-Import Bank, claiming that there has been a failure to properly consider environmental impacts for loans they make in the United States that get implemented overseas. And the effects we're fighting about happen overseas. Does that sort of get there? Okay. No. I have to tell you, I don't mean to jump on you, Ivan, but I've been surprised. Usually the best questions are the ones people preface by saying, this may be a stupid question. So that they're the ones that get to the heart of things typically.
Well, if NEPA doesn't have a citizen suit provision, how do you bring suit for an agency? Like, for example, how did this suit come about?
Mm-hmm. You're talking about in the NTHSA case?
Yes.
Yeah. Because it was a final agency action under the Administrative Procedure Act. So this was a rule published in the Federal Register. It was a major agency action under the APA, which triggered the ability for anyone who is injured by it to sue, claiming it was an arbitrary and capricious action.
So you have to wait until it's done?
You have to have final agency action. That's absolutely correct. All the procedural hoops you have to go through for APA apply to NEPA because you have to rely on the APA to pursue it.
So is there no way to bring just the NEPA action by itself? There's hardly...
No, unfortunately. Yeah, if you're... Let me rephrase that. It depends what you mean by action. To file a lawsuit, you have to go through the APA. You can bring an appeals process within the government, where if you're an agency and you think another agency is doing something completely numbskull that violates their NEPA obligations, you can appeal it to the Council for Environmental Quality. And the CEQ is the traffic cop that resolves those fights. And if you don't like the CEQ's answer, there's one last person you can appeal to, and that's the vice president. Those are not lawsuits, but they are sort of administrative internal process you can go through if you're a government agency to fight it. Unfortunately, I can't tell you much about that process because it all takes place behind closed doors, typically. There's no records of it.
Well,
there are no published records of it.
So it's real biased, just sort of on the back of the...
Yes, but Remember I said you could get an injunction if an agency wants to take action and it hasn't gone through NEPA? What that means is you have this window, and it can be really fleeting, where the agency does its deliberation and either decides FONSI, category exclusion, or an environmental impact statement. And that, at one point, finally becomes final agency action. Usually then you have a window to sue, and that window to sue could be as short as 30 days. And that's an Administrative Procedure Act lawsuit. You're right that you can't sue before then, but, you know, and you can't sue after that time limit closes, but at that point you have a small gap that you can jump in and sue.
Did we see that in NRDC about the sonar case?
Yeah, the NRDC versus Winters case.
Yeah, Winters, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. It was about EIS and a failure to, okay.
Yeah, I'm curious, how did you hear about the Winters case?
I think actually that was for a trademark permanent injunction case, but taking the permanent injunction standard, I read that case.
Okay.
It was for a moot court project. But
Not
for environmental.
All right, not to get off track too much since we're down to 10 minutes of class. I can't believe this class is already almost over. NRDC versus Winters was actually the Department of the Navy. They were suing, NRDC was suing to stop the Navy from doing acoustic submarine demonstration projects off the coast of Hawaii, where essentially they were trying to find new ways to find silent run deep submarines by blasting the ocean with high decibel acoustic waves without, NRDC said, proper accounting for the fact that it literally blew the eardrums out of whales and dolphins and caused strandings and mammal deaths. And short answer is it won the Ninth Circuit. They got an injunction against the Navy to stop this. Went to the Supreme Court, and what do you think happened?
National defense trumps just
right.
About everything.
More deference to the agency. Remember, it's a NEPA case, ultimately. All the things about Chevron deference, all the things about deference to agency expertise, kick in with that vengeance when you're talking about the Defense Department. But you're right, that's a great example of a NEPA case here. Okay, so we've talked about direct, indirect, cumulative effects. Those effects can include not just environmental, they can be ecological, aesthetic, they can be social, they can be health. The effects can be extremely broad. So here's the critical question that goes to Joey's question. To what extent do you have to look at sort of the ripple effects? Particularly ripple effects that happen outside the United States. And that's our second case for today. And this is another one that sort of gets quoted all the time in NEPA litigation. That's the Mid-States Coalition for Progress versus Surface Transportation Board, which is a great case talking about essentially, if I build a rail line, what's my environmental footprint? And in this one, I'm going to make a call here. I'll try and get through everything, but I'm going to warn you that I suspect we're going to end up having to bleed over some of our NEPA discussion at the beginning of Thursday's class, which means we will try and cover all of the Endangered Species Act with a little bit less time than I'd hoped, which means it may bleed over to the following week, which is fine. The Clean Water Act discussion, I think we've got a little room to play with there. Fear not if we don't get through everything today. Which means we have a little bit of breathing room right now to talk a little bit more about this case, which is essentially a challenge to decision by the Surface Transportation Board to allow the construction of a rail line that would convey Powder River Basin coal in Wyoming more cheaply and effectively. And the challenge was, to what extent did an environmental impact statement following that decision have to account for the indirect effects of enhanced coal burning? In other words, it's not just laying the rail. If coal is cheaper and people can get it more easily, does the environmental impact statement must include the environmental impact of burning that coal, including its climate change effects? So I'll pause here. Let me give you the heart, and then we can talk about what that might mean and how it might extrapolate it. Essentially, what the court said was that indirect effects mean any effects that are further in time or in distance from the actual direct action, but nonetheless are reasonably foreseeable. So to a certain extent, it kind of brings up echoes of your tort standards. That meant that even if it's to some extent unpredictable or speculative, because you don't know how much additional coal is being generated or burned because of this rail line, what you do know for a fact is that there will be some more. That's the whole point of the rail line. So you can require an assessment of that increase in coal, as long as the regulations make clear, some frank acknowledgement of the band of uncertainty around those numbers. If an agency says, essentially, I know more coal will be burned, but I can't say how much, what the agency can't do is say, therefore I won't consider it. What it has to do is say, I will consider it, but here are the things I don't know, and here's what those gaps in my knowledge might mean and their importance in my analysis. So essentially, you're aware of and conscious of your ignorance on certain aspects. So, and that meant in this case, the Surface Transportation Board did have to consider the impact of enhanced coal burning related from the coal rail line construction. Notice, and this is a case that doesn't get flagged this way, it is a climate change case. This is a case where the Surface Transportation Board said, we don't have to consider this rail line's effect on coal. The Clean Air Act comes to our rescue. Remember, Title IV caps the burning of coal and requires a mass cap and trade system, which will mandate that there will not be an increase of air pollutants being burned from the coal. The court's response was, true, but only for sulfur dioxide. Remember, that's all Title IV regulates. Carbon dioxide is not regulated, and therefore the enhanced burning of coal will have a direct greenhouse gas effect that Title IV in the Clean Air Act will not capture at the time of this decision. That doesn't necessarily mean it's still the case now, by the way. So with that in mind, this case really kind of solidifies and makes clear that you have to consider indirect effects based on changes in consumption and use created by infrastructure, created by expansion or installation of infrastructure. Pausing here, that brings me to the last case, which I'll serve up, and then maybe the best way to start our next class is going through some examples of how we'll apply these. Our third and final case is the Border Power Plant Working Group versus Department of Energy case, which is a district court case. This one's a fun one. This is the one that's going to have some direct relevance to folks here in Texas. Namely, this is a challenge to the issuance of a presidential permit, which would allow the construction of transmission lines across the United States border from California to Mexico to basically make possible the importation of electricity from Mexican coal-fired power plants. Basically, the Department of Energy said, take this cup away from me. Our environmental assessment shows that there is no significant impact here because, A, these power plants are in Mexico. What agency action is relevant here when we have no jurisdiction over those extraterritorial assets? Which goes in a way to your question, Joey. Number two, even if we never build this transmission line, these power plants are going to be selling electricity to someone else. So therefore, there's no significant impact here. The short answer on this decision with this court is wrong. Try again, agency. You do have to conduct a more detailed environmental assessment and determine whether an environmental impact statement is necessary, because while you're right that you don't have to consider the power plants outside the United States in your NEPA, you do have to consider the transmission lines, and one indirect effect of these transmission lines is the demand alteration of those Mexican power plants. In other words, you can't regulate the power, you can't look at the power plants in NEPA, but you can look at the transmission lines, and one of the effects of the transmission lines includes collateral effects of the power plants. It's a bank shot, but it does sort of inject it. Does that make sense, Carolyn? Okay, I wasn't sure if you're giving me the look of like, what the hell is he talking about? So, what does that mean? It means the court did a deep dive, which was actually rather fascinating. They looked at what these power plants were going to do if the transmission line was not built. And it turned out that if you look at the turbines within the plant, some were dedicated solely to this transmission line and would not be installed absent the transmission line. So the NEPA assessment disregarded the other turbines that sold to Mexican sources, but required an environmental impact statement consideration or environmental impact review of whether an EIS is required for those turbines that were going to supply the California market. So that means that you're extending our discussion of the NTHSB discussion of indirect effects to now be cross-border with transmission lines. So I'll take a deep breath here. That means basically local domestic actions that have international consequences may trigger an environmental assessment of that international consequence. It may mean if, for example, a Mexican power plant is selling power across the border into Texas, we're going to start thinking about what the EIS obligations are related to that importation of power. Hold that in your thought, because I want to plant a question with you that I'm actually wrestling with as part of our discussion with the EPA that I'd actually appreciate your input on at the start of next class. Before we finish up, let me make sure we don't miss a couple of other really important things. Number one, on cumulative impact. The key thing is on cumulative impact is that not every cumulative impact, let me rephrase that. Cumulative impact doesn't mean look at the rest of the world's atmosphere based on everyone else's emissions, and therefore, because there's a cumulative impact on climate, we must consider the additional impact of this action. You still have to look at that increment your action is adding to those others and what the reasonable alternatives are to it. So it's not just basically no project left behind. Everybody still has to go through this initial threshold step to make sure that even with the context of cumulative impacts elsewhere, your addition is making some substantive difference.
And that also includes your subtraction, right?
Yes. To what extent your subtraction could be bigger. Interesting. Yeah. What sort of environmental impact statement do you have to do if you're doing a carbon capture and sequestration project? And someone says you should be doing twice as much. That probably would be, in light of our cases, a theoretical good basis for a challenge. Two final things, very quickly. One, standing. Going back to Joey's question. Standing does apply. You still have to meet Article 3 irreducible standing requirements. There are some quirks with NEPA, though. Namely, remember the three requirements you have to show, basically, injury in fact that's fairly traceable to the conduct of the defendant that is redressable by the decision of the court. With NEPA, since we're talking about really is a procedural injury, redressability is almost assumed. You don't have to go through a discussion on that. The redressability is make the agency reconsider its decision. Boom, you're done. In terms of fairly traceable to the actual defendant, that's sometimes easier to prove because essentially the agency's failure to do a full consideration directly translates into what injury you're claiming. The problem is that injury in fact, that first irreducible core. And you have to show some type of direct personal injury beyond the fact that you're a member of the public and you're aggrieved by the agency's action. So that leaves us in with the final points. Your book is behind the curve in an important respect. CEQ has updated its guidance. It has the 2010 guidance. There's now a 2014 guidance of December of last year, and it does change the rules of the game. One, it does keep the same 25,000 ton rule of thumb. Essentially, the agency, CEQ, says that if an agency action will result in an increase of direct emissions of 25,000 tons per year, the presumption is that that is sufficient to be a significant impact and require some assessment. If it's less, it's case by case. But it's not a bright line, so the agency can still push back. But generally, what that really means is that if you have a 25,000 ton CO2 emission footprint, you're probably looking at doing something underneath at that point. Number two, the guidance now includes land use and natural resource management by the federal government. And that's a big change. And that's going to have a significant impact in terms, for example, of issuance of permits for fracking on national forests and national preserves. And now the final thought, and then the thing I'd like you all to think about. The final thought is there such a thing as a reverse environmental impact statement? Picture a facility that's seeking a permit. It does an environmental impact statement, but the environmental impact statement fails to consider the effect that climate change will have on that facility. Building a bridge that's going to be too low when the ocean levels rise. Building a highway and a portion of the coast that's going to disappear under erosion. Building a plant that's going to be in an area where the water is going to be gone that it needs to operate. There is a growing body of law saying that environmental impact statement is insufficient if it fails to do this reverse assessment of how climate change affects the desirability or impact of that project. Instead of how the facility affects climate change, how climate change affects the facility. Very new area of law, just now starting to develop. And with that sort of final thought, let me plant the seed for discussion we can start with on Thursday, which is, imagine the following. The clean power plan. While it's being implemented, while it's being fought in the courts, Texas basically says, hell no, we won't go. EPA issues a FIP. The FIP takes effect at some point, let's say 2017. Part of the FIP allows trading, which EPA has said expressly they were going to try and do. A utility located in, let's say, El Paso, rather than retrofit their coal-fired power plant, instead wants to go in and replace a dirty coal-fired power plant in Mexico with a natural gas turbine. Is that something that's going to require a NEPA assessment, and why? And if you're going to challenge it, what would you argue on both sides of that case? Because that was teed up at our meeting with the general counsel. That's something to think about. It's going to be a big issue. Right now, people are pretty comfortable with the idea of in-state trading, particularly with ERCOT. But when you start getting across the border, it's going to get really dicey. So does that make sense for everybody? Good way to start up. And I promise not to lecture quite so much next class. Just this was a lot of ground to cover pretty quickly. All right, so our door alarm is going off, which means it's time to wrap up. Last chance for any other questions, thoughts, ideas, suggestions. Okay, then everyone, enjoy the day, and I will see you on Thursday.